Welcome to Writing the Wrong Way, where we talk about how writing works, how writers work, and how the best writers risk being strange. And I'm talking today with one of my favorite people on the planet, Suzette Mayer, the author of many great books and recent winner of the Giller Prize for her most recent book, which is The Sleeping Car Porter. And great book, although... you know, it's hard to pick my favorite. My favorite book is of yours, is of course. I always blank on the long line name. Dr. Edith Vane and the
Haunting of Crawley Hall.
Hairs of Crawley Hall.
One that was dedicated to you.
Yes, that's why it's my favorite book. The only book that was ever dedicated to me.
Oh, yeah. So far.
Yeah. Till your next one, right?
<That's>
or till
right.
My daughter does one, maybe.
That's right. Yeah.
Actually, you know what's funny with that? So my daughter's doing a manuscript of poetry. You know, she was showing me drafts of it. And yeah. At one point she did have a dedication in the draft, and it was like to me. And then I remember seeing a later manuscript and she had changed it to something else.
You'd had a fight and she was like, forget it.
Yeah. No, it was like some friend of hers had something happen to them, but like, you know, it was justifiable. And I remember thinking like, oh, that hurts. But yeah, she let me see the drafts though. That was her mistake. I didn't bother her about it though, but I thought that was cute. Yeah. But yeah, so Suzette, there's a lot of things I would love to talk with you about. One thing I'll just say right up front here is that for people listening, I will give you the warning that I like to give my students, which is that I'm very likely to like ruin these books for you by just randomly, whenever I pops in my head, talking about what happens or how they end or whatever. But one thing that I think is really interesting about that particular book that you just did, Sleeping Car Porter, is you've got a great so a number of your books over the years have been in that, for lack of a better phrase, have been in kind of a magic realist mode.
Yeah.
Sleeping Car Porter, you could argue, isn't, but there is in it the potential to interpret what is happening or what, you know, Baxter, the main character, is seeing. Whether you're interpreting it as, you know, these are really things he's seeing or not, it's a bit of an open question. You've got some interesting moments in that book where it's implied that possibly he or other figures are themselves supernatural in nature, mm-hmm. without necessarily or not, and you've got just a very ambiguous moments, whereas in other books you've often, they're not ambiguous, it's, you know, very clearly, you know, this thing is happening. But then you also have a book like Monoceros, where it's not necessarily in a kind of supernatural vein in any way, but you have like these characters who are haunted, mm-hmm. By this event that has taken place, the suicide of this one character. And the book is kind of structured around that. And so you'll sometimes move into the supernatural mode, you'll sometimes not. You'll sometimes have it sort of in a magic realist way, kind of just sitting beside a more realist mode, or you'll just imply its potential. But it strikes me that however you're handling that, you seem to really be attached to this idea of haunting, mm-hmm. Particularly in the book since you moved to Coach House. Like you've had, like Monoceros, of course, you know, the Hairs of Crawley Hall is basically a haunted house novel, although mm-hmm. it's not a house. And then you could argue that Sleeping Car Porter is sort of a haunted train on some level, although, you know, it's not necessarily confirmed that this is the true situation in any way, shape, or form. But I'm really curious to know just how you find that. What's your attraction to that haunting, that idea of haunting?
So I could go. That's a good question. I'd have to think about it for a while. But I think my initial reaction to that question is that, and I think we've talked about this before, or I've talked about it before, that I think I grew up in a haunted house. And by haunted house, I don't mean that there were ghosts, but I grew up with a mother whose both of her parents were dead by the time she was 18. And they had, so her father died when she was, I think, 15, and then her mother died when she was like 17 or 18, and no, 18. And it's not that we grew up in an unhappy household, because we didn't, but there was always a lack there. There was always, whenever my mother was really mad at me, she would always win the argument by saying, "Well, at least you have a mother." It was always that was like the trump card. And how can you fight that? I guess it's true. I guess at least I have a mother. And, in combo with that absence, and I think that kind of, I would say that there is an overlay of grief there from her, and also my father never had a father, as in, when he was three, his father died. So it was such a different household compared to what I knew from, friends who would talk about their grandparents, and also their grandparents spoke their language, whereas my grandmother spoke German. Like, we shouldn't even speak to her. So it was this very, it was just a different way of growing up. In combination with that was the fact that my mother is from the Bahamas and in the Caribbean. And I had a conversation with Andre Alexis about this as well, because I was just wondering, if is it just me and our family, or is it other people, where there is an understanding of the proximity of the supernatural and of the dead. There's an understanding of that in those cultures, which is different from what we have here in North America. So in North America, when you talk about haunting, when you talk about the supernatural, it's Halloween. That's Halloween. That's something you do on Halloween. That's haunted house rides. Whereas in the Caribbean, it's just closer. It's closer. And so I think, having grown up with that kind of background, and then also, I've always felt there's got to be more to it than this. Like, what I'm seeing and apprehending, or what I'm apprehending with my senses, there's got to be more than this. So it could also just be wishful thinking, that, come on now, there's got to be other dimensions. Because this, some of the shit that happens in this world is just like, it's enough. I'm sick of it. I'm done with this. Please, please let there be other possibilities. Please let there be magic. But as you grow up, as a kid, when I was a kid, I was convinced that I could sink things into being, sometimes against my will. And then as you get older and older, you realize, oh, I wish.
Well, that is, and also you, well, one of the things that you were talking about the dead and this proximity thing. Something I often think about is, I forget where, but somewhere Jean Baudrillard writes about how the one of the foundational moves that has created sort of the modern West was the exclusion of the dead, and then, but by virtue of doing that, you have to then ritualize their, proximity, yeah, in these strange, carnivalesque ways, like you were talking about, like at Halloween or whatever else. Whereas it strikes me that your novels have a more integrated, this more integrated aspect where, the supernatural is, it gets integrated often to the point where it's not even necessarily clear if it's there, which is in a weird sort of paradox. But just that potential is there, and characters may or may not, buy into this potential. But they're, it again, in a sense, kind of haunted by its possibility. And then, maybe Baxter is an interesting character too, because he's a figure who is, on one hand, very accepting of certain things, but on the other hand, just trying to constantly deny certain things, like whether that's the reality he's looking around, or aspects of his sexuality, or just how to act in this situation. There's a rule, right? He has to follow, or he's going to get penalized. Like that idea, which is built into his job, is really part, like, struck. It's just a thread throughout his life, by virtue of who he is and what time he's living in, and yeah, his social class, et cetera, et cetera. but he has this, you know, dream of mobility. Not just he's going to become a dentist and so on, but just in all these different aspects. One of the things I really liked about the book was you take a lot of material that is not necessarily uncommon, but you have such an interesting take on it compared to other writers, because, and you do this in Monoceros as well, very deftly, I thought, where you have, you know, material that in one hand is very tragic, but it's very funny. And there's a lot of like hopefulness, and like him flying the kite at the end is such a beautiful moment, you know, where he just really gets to have fun flying a kite. You know, these terrible things have happened, and on other levels he's just been suffering like from one minute to the next, you know, but he gets these pockets of like, you know, his sort of coworkers sticking up for him on a certain level, getting to fly the kite, you know, having these little isolated incidents of freedom. I'm curious to know, just sort of, again, in Monoceros, for people who haven't read that book, Monoceros, again, sort of deals with the fallout in this community of this character having committed suicide, sort of various people who knew him or didn't know him, but nevertheless are kind of in the wave path of it. You know, they're sort of affected by this event and this situation, but it's not necessarily, I mean, there's a lot of humor and joy in it as well, you know, in a weird sort of way. And so it becomes kind of the catalyst for certain people to kind of find themselves on a certain level. So I'm really curious to know how you hold those sort of two poles side by side, whereas most people like to separate them, if that makes sense.
I've thought about that before, because, you know, it's, I'm sorry to say that sometimes it's just by accident, and when I've tried to do it deliberately, it just doesn't work, you know. So if I try to make something funny, it's just not funny. If I try to make something tragic, it's maudlin, you know.
Maybe counterpoint is the way to phrase it. Like, you seem to work with counterpoint in a really interesting way.
I think it's just, you know, I try really, really, really hard to report things as they are. Like, one of the most satisfying things I ever heard, I think it was like, what's his name, David Cronenberg's version of, you know, that film, the adaptation he did of Naked Lunch, there's a point where I don't think this is William S. Burroughs' language. I think this is actually David Cronenberg's language, where the typewriter with the anus talks, and it says something like, you know, writers are, you know, just as sad as other people. There's, you know, they live their regular lives. The only difference is they file a report on it. And so I've always felt like more of a reporter of, you know, what I'm recording, what I see, you know, as I see it, as opposed to trying to impose any kind of, well, this is how you should read it, or this is how you should not read it, any kind of filter like that. And I don't know, when I have intention, I suppose, it's just that whole understanding that, you know, comedy for me is tragedy at a distance. That, you know, when you are deep into something, it's got that incredible momentousness. But then, you know, years later, you can laugh about, oh, remember that time you tripped over dad's grave or whatever, you know, something like that. And it's funny. And the whole notion of, you know, dinner party stories, for example, is all about, well, you went through this very difficult time, but boy, oh boy, is that funny, pass the salt. Ha ha ha. You know, telling of stories helps kind of relieve the grief and the weight of a moment. And I think that's maybe what I'm tapping into. I life is also just complicated. Like, let's face it, right? I don't think that we ever are in situations where we're 100% one thing. You know, I don't know how many times I've been in situations where something is deeply, deeply sad. You know, you're at a funeral, for example, and somebody starts laughing about something small and it's ridiculous and adorable. It feels inauthentic to me to just have one understanding of the way a situation is unfolding.
One of the phenomena that I think is so interesting in life is where I'll find myself, like, things will be going so badly that I'll find myself thinking it's funny. Like, I'll laugh. Exactly. Like, if I was watching this, it would be hilarious. Like, it's almost like you laugh at your own, like, you stub your toe, and at a certain point, it hurts so much, you start laughing.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like you get that there's like an emotional space that's analogous to that, I think, too, where it's like something horrible happens, something, and then it's like there's a tipping point where it's like, now it's almost funny how many things that are happening to you are so horrible.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, of course that would be the case, you know. I would also get my tax bill.
It also depends on perspective, right? So if I'm watching you stub your toe, that's kind of funny for me, even though it's not funny for you, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of a minor example.
You always have had an interesting perspective on this sort of different way of thinking. I remember you telling me once, what was it? It was slightly on the side here, but I remember you saying to me once, why isn't it, like, if I love a person, you know, I love you, I love, you know, why don't I love your blood when it's outside of your body?
Yeah. I think we were talking,
like,
about
the abject aspect of it. You know, yeah. There's like a level, but there's a level where it kind of crosses, like the thing will cross states at some tipping point. Like, it's almost, I think we were talking about horror as a genre at one point, and I was saying something along the lines of, like, there's that moment in The Birds where there's just all of a sudden there's too many birds, like, behind her on the play structure, and it's weird and horrible now. But if you were going to make the Leslie Nielsen parody, you just add more birds, because there's this other tipping point where it's now ridiculous how many birds there are. It kind of crosses from normalcy to terrifying to ridiculousness. Like, those horror and comedy are kind of on that spectrum, and I think you'd probably say tragedy and comedy are kind of on that spectrum too, rather than being like the two masks and the polar opposite, you know.
Yeah, I would agree.
Actor would wear both masks. Like, that's the thing that people would often forget in the comedies.
Yeah, they're two sides of the same coin. I think what we were talking about was love poetry, where, you know, if you're, you know, the whole idea of feeding your lover a strawberry and how wonderful that is, putting it into their mouth. But at a certain point, you don't want to see that strawberry again. Like, once they've crunched it in their teeth and it's halfway down their throat, it's like, okay, you can keep it.
Yeah,
please don't give it back. And it's no longer romantic. But if
you are, but there's a line,
like,
it's weird.
Regurgitate that into my hand. Then I don't know. Is that funny?
Yeah, I'm sure somebody finds that sexy. But, like, there's a level of... but I always thought that was an interesting metaphor almost for your approach to fiction. Because you seem to me very interested in, well, where's the line where that strawberry stops being romantic? And, like, can I get close to it?
Yeah.
Is there something interesting in that, when we're close to that line?
Mm-hmm. Also, you know, I just thinking about the strawberry, I think it would be fascinating to see that strawberry being eaten up by stomach acid and seeing it be transformed into something else I don't want to see. Like, I don't want to see the stool of the strawberry, but watching the process would be interesting.
But some distance down there, right? Like, this may be like further than the normal person, but that's, I think, the writer's job on a certain level. It's like, let's go a little further than a normal person would go. I remember Neil Gaiman being interviewed about something or other, like about ideas. And he was saying, like, how does he get such great ideas or something? Like, the standard question. I remember his response is really interesting to me, where he said, he goes, a writer doesn't really get more ideas or better ideas than a normal person. It's just that they notice they're having an idea.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the average person will have 100 great ideas in a day, but they won't pay any attention to the fact that they've had an idea, and they certainly won't go execute and obsessively, like, gun that idea down, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas, like, writers have, for whatever reason, like, you know, this obsessiveness where they'll stick on an idea and they'll be like, okay, you know, I could do something with that. And they'll kind of just go further than a person should almost with the idea. And sometimes it doesn't work out, but like there's this level at which, you know, I find, at least for myself, like what I like when I'm reading, or even just, you know, what I'm looking for when I'm writing is like, is there some place that I can, that the thing goes, like, does it go, I like to say, does it go, do you go to the end of the idea? Like what I think is so interesting about, what I liked about Baxter's story is it has this literal structure of traveling from one location to the other location. And then the whole thing becomes about like, can you get to that from this place to that place? Like there's a physical journey that they're trying to complete, and there's obstacles at a certain point to its completion. But then there's also like this, you know, he has this other journey of, he needs X amount of dollars to go to dental school and get the training he wants. He's reading through a book, you know, as he goes, he's reading the science fiction novel, and he starts to hit obstacles to completing that novel, you know, because it becomes like this tool for his, to deal with this girl or whatever. And then you have like, just, you know, the whole, the dream of sort of being able to be who he wants to be without people always stopping that or isolating and clamping down like his desires. And there's like a journey that's sort of being interrupted there. Like I love how like lined up those things are and how clean, you know, the train metaphor becomes. But just to go back though to something you were saying about reportage, I know one thing that you were doing in the course of this is heavily researching like the period and trains and porters and so on. And I'm curious, you know, to what degree does kind of research for you come into these the development of these stories? Like you can see very clearly like where some of your thematic ideas and obsessions are maybe coming from, but what is like, when does it kind of become a thing that you're now fixated on enough that you're going to spend real time and energy and resources researching and so on?
So when does what, like with
this, when is like just the inkling of like, oh, this is kind of an interesting idea, like move into like, oh, you know, the like, let's just use the sleeping car porter for an example. What was the sort of the genesis of that for you? And then when did it kind of start to crystallize?
It started to crystallize. So my big problem was that I could only conceive of this book in the most general terms, as in, I want to write about a sleeping car porter. Here are some history books about sleeping car porters. And none of them, I wasn't connecting with any of it, just because it was all so very broad stroke. And I realized that what I really, really, really needed and wanted was that really granular detail about, you know, so really the moment of magic for me was when I was in Winnipeg and I was in the provincial archives, I forget what it's called now. And I was going through police records and criminal reports, and there was the police had documented what all these people who had been arrested, they've been charged with drunkenness and unruly behavior, and so they were basically thrown in the drunk tank, like the equivalent of a 1917 drunk tank, and the police made them empty their pockets, and they listed what was in their pockets. And so hearing what people carried in their pockets, really, that kind of tipped me into understanding these historical figures as actually human figures, as in, well, this guy had 17 cents and a collar and a single match. This person had a bobby pin and a, you know, a scrap of hanky or whatever, or just crumbs from the scones they ate earlier in the day. That was a magical moment. And that's when I could get, you know, what you talk about, sorry about my dog barking in the background there, but get to that moment of, I guess, the obsession I needed to follow through, you know, because I could I could figure out what mattered to these people by what was in their pockets. And so I could think about, well, what does my character have in his pockets? In addition to, you know, the timetables and the whatever the official documents he needs, what does he have in his pockets? And what does that say about him? Do you want me to go and get my dog to shut up?
Well, for people who don't know, which is probably everybody on the planet, so this dog is also her agent and manager. So I feel like that reason, it would be improper to tell
he's
your dog
negotiating
to shut up.
He's negotiating a contract.
Yeah, right. That's his job, right? So
I don't know. But seriously, I could go and get him to be quiet. I think he's quiet.
It's up to you. It's fine by me.
Okay.
It's pretty far in the background, so it adds a little bit of color. It's not like over top what you're saying or anything.
Good.
Yeah.
It's just so distracting. Anyway. So the research and really the structure of that book, the structure of the Sleeping Car Porter came about because I was so afraid of getting the details wrong. You know, like I had to do a lot of world building basically to figure out, okay, when am I writing? What am I writing? What are the parameters of this world? And I realized that I was only comfortable when the characters were on the train, because there's in Cranbrook, BC, which I visited multiple times, there's a perfectly restored sleeping car from 1929 there. And there's a perfectly restored dining car. And so I knew whenever I walked in there, okay, it's like, okay, here I am. I am in 1929. This is exactly what I would see. This is the pattern of the carpet. This is the texture of the carpet. This is the texture of the upholstery. This is what the light would look like. And so I knew that, okay, if I can, it's just me being terrified and, well, being a coward, which is, I know that if I'm on the train, I know what I'm doing. Once I get off the train, once the characters get off the train, I really don't know what I'm doing. And it's me just being scared. And then luckily, it just worked out that, you know, I thought this would be a really interesting kind of claustrophobic environment where all kinds of, you know, all kinds of interactions and struggles could occur because of the limitations of this space. You know, it's really, I remember you were so annoying when you were a student at UC, because I remember I'd written Monoceros or something, or I was working on it, and you said, yeah, I want to hear about it. Like, tell us about it.
Yeah, I would keep bothering you about it.
Yeah, because I think we were trying to start a speaker series, and you're like, well, why don't you give a talk on it? And I was like, oh, shit. And then I had to think about, okay, well, what is my process? It was great. I mean, this is why you're such a valuable, interesting person, aside from your, you know, you're just a great person, but you're always poking me and asking me hard questions. And I really appreciate that, because then it can't just be, well, that's what I felt like. It's kind of like, well, what was I actually doing?
I always say that my mild credit that I deserve for your career is telling you when you were complaining about Monoceros. Mm-hmm. And the manuscript and how people didn't seem interested in it. You didn't know if there's something wrong with it or whatever. I remember saying to you, well, maybe they're losers and you should just have a better editor like Alana Wilcox look at it.
It's true.
I don't think you were criticizing your editor at the time, so I don't want to accidentally say that. But I was just like, maybe the problem isn't you. Maybe the problem isn't the book. Maybe it's, you know, you need to get with Coach House.
Yeah, it's because I was in a no man's land, because my agent had dropped me and the publisher of the last book was not answering me. And I'm like, what am I going to do?
Sure, that's what
like,
it was.
Try Coach House.
I was like, get a better publisher.
Yeah, get a better publisher, get a different publisher.
Yeah, it's not, you're not the problem, is it?
You've also managed at certain times of my life to just say things like, well, who cares what they think? Just do it. Who cares? Whatever. So what if it's, you know, this person is defying gravity? Just make it happen.
Just make it happen. But yeah, I don't think I deserve really any real credit. But I always think, just to sort of jump back for a second, though, sometimes that's like what people need, in the sense that, again, this is why I call this whole thing writing the wrong way. I find that like the trajectory of a person's career, no matter who they are, is like they start out and they're doing everything wrong and they suck. And they know they suck. At a certain point, they realize they suck. Often, that's one of the biggest things. You have to realize you're terrible and get over your like ego that just because you're writing, you're better than everybody else. But once you realize you're actually truly terrible and you're doing things wrong, they'll start to seek, you'll start to seek out like, how do I do things the right way? And you'll go take a class, you'll do this, you'll do that, you'll read books. Eventually, you know, you start to learn how to do it. Mm-hmm. But the problem with that is what you learn effectively is how to be like other people. And that's fine to a degree, but you have to, at a certain point, I think, get back to, well, once you're like everyone else, the problem then becomes you've lost your interest in the thing, because something you were doing wrong initially, like something that you weren't doing the way everyone else does it, was in fact the thing that interested you about it. But now you've been told to lose that thing. So like, maybe, you know, you, I don't know, it could be anything. Maybe you like to write in second person, but no one writes well in second person. So then, you know, you're told not to write in second person, and then you don't. And then you do get better, but you've kind of lost the thing that mattered to you in the first place, whatever. So it could be anything, but just, you know, as an example, what I find so often is like, people need to kind of have a disciplined approach to getting back to doing something wrong, but making it work.
Yes.
And I feel like with Monoceros, at least, you were kind of in that space where like, you were a very excellent writer and you had your own voice and everything by that point. But there was a thing you were doing in that book, which was sort of the opposite of what other people would be doing. And you were kind of torn, where it seemed like on one level it wasn't working because everyone would keep telling you it wasn't working.
Yeah.
You're like, you can't have a kid commit suicide and that be the centerpiece of a hilarious book. But, well, you know, it did work. And because you had to figure out how to make it work. But people have that knee-jerk reaction of like, before they read it, they have to hear, they hear about it, and then mm-hmm. they kind of bring that perception in.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas interesting
what you talk about with writing the wrong way, because I think it was you who, I had written maybe three books, I can't remember. Anyway, and you said to me, oh, so what you do is you write a realist novel, and then you just, at the very end, you put some supernatural stuff in it. And I'm like, oh, that's true. Because I think I was also complaining about a book I'd written, Venus Hum, where it changes genres halfway through.
Yeah, I love that.
And how that's wrong. You're not allowed to do that. And then, because it started out as more of a realist book, and then suddenly it turns into a narrative about vampires halfway through. And I remember just despairing. And then I think it was you who said, well, you know, there's that movie From Dusk Till Dawn that starts out one way, and then suddenly it becomes this vampire story. So it was great to have somebody identify, you know, I felt what I was doing was wrong just because everybody else was telling me how weird it was to just, why do you have this supernatural stuff in here? But you basically identified that, well, that's my thing. And it's true.
And
it's
if
what
it
I
works.
Love to do. And if it works, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Venus Hum is the first of your books that I read. And I loved that. I thought it was so great. I mean, I was enjoying the book, but once that happened, I was like, wow, this is great. I was, you know, really blown away. And it became really influential. Because if you remember, like, something that people, Suzette knows, but other people don't know, is that Suzette was my advisor at the University of Calgary when I was doing a PhD. And my creative thesis was a novel. And very much that's what the novel was. It was like, can I make a story where it kind of moves progressively from realism to something more akin to surrealism? Mm-hmm. Can I just progressively move in that direction and kind of have these stark, you know, shifts like Suzette did in Venus Hum? But I was like, could I get more extreme with it? Or, you know, we'll see, you know, if I ever can finalize that draft, we'll see who wins. Yeah. Suzette, but like that being very, very influential on me, because I'd seen a few examples of it, but it's hard to do. Thomas Ligotti, if you haven't read, by the way, Suzette, there's a book, Thomas Ligotti.
Ligotti, yeah.
He wrote, did you read My Work Is Not Yet Done?
No.
It's not his best, but he does that exact thing partway through. He like, all, it's fascinating. Like, it's like kind of like a realist sort of novel. And then all of a sudden, like, literally, like, the character says, And then something bizarre happened, and I became imbued with these powers. it's deranged, and the shift is so shocking and stark, but it just works so well because of the voice that he's established. And you know, anyway, it reminds me sort of a different approach, but it has that same sort of, you know, just shift in a hard, weird direction. Yeah, like I always thought that what you did on a certain level was weird fiction.
Yeah.
Like a bit much classier and more blended with certain other tropes. But, you know, fundamentally, I think I would class you as a modern weird author.
Oh, well, thank you. I'll take that. It also makes me think of, you know, Flannery O'Connor's A Good Man Is Hard to Find.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where that story starts out as, oh, it's just a family on a road trip. And then suddenly when the car flips over, it becomes this serial killer story. It's amazing.
It is an amazing story. I think you introduced me to that story, actually. I want to jump back to something you said. You said you wanted to write about sleeping car porters, but like, why did you know that? Like, where did that idea come from?
That was just Fred Waugh telling me I have to write about sleeping car porters. So he was my old creative writing poetry teacher. And he told me to write about, I did, you know what? That's a lie. When I say I knew I wanted to write about sleeping
that's
car
so
porters,
interesting.
That's a pure lie. I didn't want to write about sleeping car porters.
But Fred Waugh told you to?
He told me to. And I thought, you know, okay, I'll just have this topic on the back burner. I'm going to work on the stuff I'm actually interested in. And I'll have this stuff on the back burner. And like I've told you before, it was my fake book. It was the book that I held up to keep people off of me.
You always said that over the years. Yeah, you would keep bringing. Yeah. I would keep asking you about this train book because I didn't know it was about the porter so much. But you kept talking about this train book. You were in Winnipeg researching it and everything.
Yeah,
and you're like, oh, this is just my fake book that I just pretend that I'm writing.
Well, because people kept saying, kept asking me, what are you writing on? What are you writing on? And you know, I teach at U of C, and we were supposed to get shirt grants. And I don't want people doing research for me. I need to do my own work. I don't want to hire a research assistant. And so I got the grant, and then it's like, I thought, okay, well, this seems the most obvious kind of project for a research assistant. And then when I got the chance to find out literally what did people carry in their pockets when they were arrested for being drunk, what did they carry in their pockets in 1917? It was like, oh, this is actually kind of cool. But I really was not interested in the sleeping car porters, partly because every time I brought them up or talked about them, people would say, oh, so you're going to talk about the unions, right? You're going to talk about the brotherhood. You're going to talk about this X, Y, Z. And it was all about show us how amazing these men are, lift them up, you know, give us the good story. And I just am so, that is not my thing. I would rather turn over the rock and see the maggots then look at the rock and appreciate how beautiful the rock is. I don't care. Like, I want to know what's going on underneath. And I knew I didn't want to write about unions and brotherhoods or anything like that. And I don't find that books that are about uplifting a group of people are very interesting. That just reads like somebody's agenda to me. So it was me trying to figure out, you know, who are the individuals, who are possible individuals behind this? And it became really clear, like the maggots under the rock moment was when I was in the Pullman archives in Chicago. And, you know, there was all of this literature associated with the creation of the unions, et cetera, et cetera. But there were also lots of indications of people who didn't want the unions, you know? So there was this handwritten, like this pencil letter, clearly written by a porter to the union guys saying, this is the worst idea ever, and I'm going to come get you, you losers, like whatever, using 1925 language. But, you know, and it was like, oh, like you could read his rage on the paper. It was fabulous. I just love that. But nobody wanted to talk about nobody wanted to talk about the uglier parts of it.
At the same time, though, it's not an ugly book, you know, like there's this ugly stuff in it, sure. But, you know, it's a book that has a real affection for Baxter and sympathy for some of the other people involved in the story, and you have these beautiful little moments. I just keep going back to the kite. I'm really curious about that kite scene that you kind of ended the book on, and how you kind of settled on that as how you're going to end this book.
That was because I knew that I needed to have a happy ending. I just did not want to write a book. Another reason why I resisted writing this book for so long was that I thought there is no way this is going to be a book about hope. There's no way this is going to be a book that's even remotely funny because I'm writing about Black oppression and Black pain. Like being a sleeping car porter was hard, horrible, degrading work. And I also was writing about somebody who was in the closet, who, if it was discovered that he was gay, at the very least he'd lose his job. He probably all kinds of other terrible things would happen to him. And I thought, I don't want to write that book. I don't want to write about pain for queer people. I don't want to write about pain for Black people. I need to have a happy ending. And or no, I thought I can't write it. And then I was talking to my friend Julia Gauntz, who's also a writer, really interesting writer. And I said, here's my dilemma. I'm going back into a history that's really hard, and it will never end happily. And she said, you're a fiction writer. Make it happen. You can make a happy ending. And I thought, okay, how can I make a happy ending that is realistic? So I wrote that scene actually quite early on, once I figured out who Ferdinand was with his kite. And somebody suggested, because in early drafts, I had this character, this porter who had a kite. He just had a kite, had a kite, had a kite. And I'm like, well, so what if he has a kite? And a friend of mine said, well, why don't you make the kite, an object that his wife sewed for him? So it's him actually just taking his wife along with him everywhere. And I thought that's actually really beautiful. And I also thought too, this whole union thing, brotherhood thing, it's not that it's not important, it's super important, but I'm much more interested in the sentiment behind it and how brotherhood can occur. And the fact that, it's not a happily ever after with a lover at the end of the book, but it's a happily ever after with your friend, your friend. And the fact that he's been in this claustrophobic space for so long and he finally gets to just run full out and use his body was really important to me. But I do People never note this, but the sky is cloudy that the kite is flying in,
Sure.
so that's me being, for the kind of English majors out there. Well, it's not a shine, it's not a sunshiny day, it's a cloudy day. So what does that mean? Well, it's either Vancouver, because Vancouver's always cloudy, or it, suggests, it's not going to be an easy.
Yeah, but he gets that moment, like I don't think there's any suggestion that he's going to go live an easy life in this novel. He hasn't really, in many ways, resolved many of his issues or problems that he has in life. He's got some resolution, like he's got money that he didn't have before, and so on. But yeah, but just even to get that moment, I think, it's well, just to kind of cycle back though to something you were just saying for a second. You've said versions of what you just said over the years to me, which is that you've expressed this real distaste for stories that just sort of hammer tragedy after tragedy in relation to Black people or queer people or whatever. Like, and this sort of I mean, on one level, you just seem very much to have a distaste for that genre. And I'm curious to know, you hear you talk a bit more about that, because I know other people who maintain that is a very important genre.
I think it's partly my age. Like I came of age when the big thing on TV was Roots, and it was about a slave and the brutality he went through. And everybody was like, you must see this show. Is this an important show? You must see it. And I'm like, oh God. And it's not easy to watch. It's brutal, brutal, brutal. And I, and then we'd go to the Caribbean and visit family. And I remember seeing the slave cages. Like there were cages that you kept people in, and there were green ferns growing in these cages. And I'm like, okay, we know that story of slavery and people in cages and people being thrown over, you know, in the Middle Passage. We know that story over and over and over again, and the color purple and, you know, all of that. And also, when I was growing up, there was nothing positive about queer people, like nothing. It was either super, super coded, so to the point of oblivion, so you couldn't recognize it at all. Or, you know, it was stories like this person's dying of AIDS related causes. You know, these women are perverted, and one is going to actually, at the end of the story, I think it was the children's hour, where a woman hangs herself in it because she's in this relationship and is just feeling so tortured. Like, I that was a that was those were narratives I saw over and over and over again. I didn't grow up with the benefit of, you know, happy endings for queer people. It was always you got punished at the end, or somebody, you know, if it's a story about two women, one of them ends up marrying a guy or whatever. And with Black people, it was always these very, you know, it was either comedies like, I don't know, The Cosby Show or The Jeffersons, which I loved, or it was these deeply tragic, brutal shows. And it's the Sleeping Car Porter is me writing against that tradition, really. And you know, also to be fair, like I was talking about the book in a history class recently, and there was a student in the class, a young queer woman, who she didn't know what the ending was because this was very early days. The book had just come out, and nobody was reading it yet except for this class. And she said that when she reached the end, she was shocked by the ending because she assumed that this person, that the main character Baxter, well, at the end of the story, he's going to be punished or he'll be killed or whatever. So it's for me, it felt like a radical moment of, you know what, here's, you get to read some history, you get to see the hard parts, but you also get to see somebody experiencing tremendous joy and possibility and hope, and it's aspirational.
It's interesting that you say use the word radical, because it does strike me as the one sort of genre where, other than horror perhaps, where a happy ending is radical. I've always wondered why the culture fetishizes extreme tragedy in that sort of way. I always think of the movie Precious. If you, I started laughing in the movie Precious, because at a certain point it's just. Like it's just one thing after another. You get to that absurdist point at a certain level, and you know, to me, it's kind of emblematic of. I mean, there's very good stories in that genre. Don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting, you know, that Roots is terrible or something. But like, I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen it for a while. There is that level of like, there's a fetishization of the tragedy that gets extremist, and then you know, I have. Not seen too many people reacting against, other than you and maybe a handful of others. And I mean, there's place for all sorts of stories, but
Of course,
I
of
wonder like
course.
why I've always wondered why that why the culture is so bound up in that. But maybe it's just a cultural thing in that we vault tragedy over comedy. Like you don't give the Oscar to a comedy
Oh,
anyway.
yeah, that's
So maybe it
true.
just has to do with the broader cultural idea that tragedy is worthy of serious note.
I think it's still, it might also be about, like, especially with Black, you know, this insistence on these deeply tragic stories. Like you said, it's not like there isn't room for them. There absolutely is. And these things do happen. But it strikes me that it's a repeated kind of putting Black people in their place. So even if you are a successful person, well, I still get to, as a white person or as a non-Black person, I still get to feel sorry for you, you know. It's a repeated victimization,
Yeah, that's
of a
interesting.
group of people, you know. And with queer people, well, you know, I don't believe in your, I think you live a lifestyle. I don't think you lead a real life. I think you're secretly perverted. But if you die, well, oh, geez, well, that's sad. And okay, as
You
long
never
as
got
you're,
to live a real life. Yeah, that's an interesting, yeah. On a lighter note, I'm curious to just jump back to that world building idea. You're talking about like building the world and the car, and you did all this research towards building that world. I think often people don't like this book is ostensibly, if you kind of filter out the potential for supernatural activity, which you could, as a reader, you can completely interpret it with that filtered out. I think a lot of people don't think about that more realist mode as one in which one has to do world building. You know, people often think of the word world building and they reserve it for like, it's an epic fantasy Game of Thrones and you got, you know, where's Gondor, you know, in relation to the, you know what I mean? Like the black, whatever. I just, you know, lost on my Lord of the Rings cred there, but, and people, but you know, but I think you use the word so well in that way that like, yeah, world building does also just apply to like this car, train car or whatever eight location that we're isolated in and the claustrophobia sets in. And I've always just personally, I like claustrophobic stories. I like, I don't know, this is a, if you paid attention when you were reading my Lightning Impossible stories, but like I have so many stories that are like, there's one person, there's two people, three people are talking, there's one room, there's no location, you know, it's just a letter that somebody wrote to another person, you know, like it's so claustrophobic in so many ways. Like I find, that's just part of my personal like writerly DNA, but I always liked the claustrophobic stories. That's one of the things I also liked about your last two books in particular is they have that claustrophobia, you know, in their bones on a certain level, and they keep getting more and more closed in a certain way. Crawley Hall especially, like there's even as the place is expanding on some level, there's like this her the character's domain of activity starts to get smaller and smaller and smaller. And there's like a spiraling effect in some ways I find with sort of some of your work that I really like. Like if things will just start to spiral around one another and it'll get tighter and more claustrophobic, like how these dynamics are relating. And I'm just kind of curious to know, like, something I don't think I've ever actually asked you before is what are some of your like big influences? Because I know where I got that from, where I got that interest from is reading Sandman number 6 by Neil Gaiman, where Sandman number 6 is the comic where Dr. Destiny has taken this crystal from Sandman that allows you to control other people. And he goes to a diner and the whole issue is inside this diner where Dr. Destiny is just taking control of the people and forcing them to like slaughter one another in strange and increasingly creative ways. Eventually they're all dead. He's just bored sitting there because he's got nothing else to do. And then the Sandman shows up on the last page. He's not even in the issue. He doesn't save anyone. And it's just this absolute nightmare claustrophobia. And I always think for me, everything goes back to Sandman number 6 on a certain level. And I can think of a couple other things where the big moments in the creative influence growing up. I'm curious just to know, like, for you, like, what are the big influences that you kind of see in your own work?
As far as claustrophobia?
Well, just as far as anything. Just, you know, the things that really made the impression on you.
Yeah. I remember reading Gertrude Stein's The Autobiography of Alice B. Toklas and just being blown away by her language, just the way she used language, you know, or Tender Buttons. I couldn't tell you what Tender Buttons is about. Like, I've read it many times, I've taught it, I still don't know what the hell that book is about, but you know, the fact that she has lines like sugar is a vegetable, I can totally see myself imitating in a line from Edith Vane. Like, I think I have a line that goes, time is gelatin or something like that. Like, that's pure me ripping off Gertrude Stein because I just love that so much. And then, you know, I remember when I was doing my bachelor's degree back in the late 80s. And so we were reading some really heavily canonical work, but I always avoided Victorian literature because those books were too damn big. And I just, it's like, no, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. So it wasn't until after I graduated, I think, that I started reading books like Jane Eyre or, well, no, we had to read Wuthering Heights. But I remember reading books like Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights, and what else was it? There was another book where they're books that are about women trapped inside, basically, you know. And outside, even when people go outside, they're on the moors, and it's the weather is gross, and you don't actually want to be there. So everybody's inside. It's never warm. Like they light fires, but nobody's ever warmed by these fires. They eat food. The food is not appealing. Probably because it's English food. I don't know. Whatever. I might have offended a few people there. Whatever.
I'm English and I completely agree.
It just always read as so dank and dark, and these women are trying to get out, but they can't even get out of their clothes because they're all bound up in these corsets. And you know, so that was super fascinating to me. And juxtaposed, you know, as alongside that is a story like A Rose for Emily, or you know, or The Yellow Wallpaper, which are once again about women in confined spaces, but they've got these like extraordinary inner lives that are, you know, that you only get a sense of. You just see traces of it, especially with Rose for Emily, like what was going on in that house. And The Yellow Wallpaper, what is actually going on in that marriage? I love those. And I remember being really loving Virginia Woolf, but only some of her books. I really loved The Years, which is this book that once again just reads as very English to me, of a certain period, not Victorian, but later, but where it's just people stuck in houses with each other, and they can't actually, even though they all speak the same language, ostensibly, nobody actually hears anyone. The food is terrible. It's just, and but it's still, you know, these are people who are well off. They're doing just fine, but their lives are so miserable. Probably I'm still stuck back then, because I was reading those books during a hugely formative time in my life, definitely. So it's this really, I wish I could, you know, I wish I could say I had other more varied influences, but really I think it was about me reading about women trapped in their clothes, trapped in their houses, eating shitty food and the sun never shining.
Well,
And then, but then I remember reading, you know, The Color Purple by Alice Walker and Beloved, and suddenly that was like, okay, it's women trapped in their houses, you know, but now it's black people. And that kind of opened up another kind of door for me that was super important.
we s both seem to have the kind of obsession with trapped, entrapment, or claustrophobia, or it's curious. I look at I got my ceiling here. I know where it comes from, but
I've got my red walls, my womb-like room.
well, I'll on that note, maybe I'll free you to go about the rest of your day, so you're not trapped as in my gaze, the gaze of the Zoom camera.
It's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure.
Well, it's always a pleasure. Again, everyone listening should check out Suzette's work. My favorite books are the last three,
Me too.
but Venus Hum is the one that, I mean, I like all your books. I haven't read anything that you've written that I didn't like a lot, but it was kind of interesting how it worked. Oh, but I just want to tell one little story though, which is when I first my first sort of encounter with Suzette was I was moving to Calgary, like I say, to do a PhD. I'd been accepted there. And Suzette was like going to take, she's running the creative writing course, and you had to apply into the creative writing course. And I remember distinctly, like, how you had to apply. I was like, well, what's the manuscript you're going to write during this manuscript development course? And I remember writing my little description of the manuscript. And so my first contact with Suzette was her emailing me saying, yeah, this is a terrible idea. It's really stock. It's really bland. She goes, your writing sample is good in the sense that it's well written, but if you have a better project, maybe I'll let you in this course. And I remember distinctly, like, I credit you with a lot of my development as a writer, not just because you taught me, but because in that moment, I literally was like, I have nothing else. And I looked at the book I was reading on the table beside me, which was Franz Kafka's America. And I looked at it and thought, well, what if I just changed the title to Canada, Canada with a K? What would that be? And I just took the plot of America and tweaked it, and then like sent that to you as like a thing. I'll still finish that book one of these days soon. But like I remember like distinctly like my whole like writing trajectory sort of ch started to change in that direct after that point because of a random like I was like, oh shit, I gotta find a way to press this woman. And I was like, maybe if I do this weird thing, but then I really liked where it started to go in the class. It was just sort of a lark to begin with. And I was like, oh, I'll figure it out later. But but then like that course was really great, and it was a great group of people too. But I remember just distinctly like that was it was such a funny interaction initially, and then but like from that point, I was like, I don't know, for whatever reason, I really liked it. I really liked how you were like, fuck this shit of yours, John. But if you have something better, maybe. I was like, that's so great, like that's what I need, I instantly was like, I hadn't even met you yet, but I was like, this is exactly what I need. This woman is the one who's going to change my life.
I think I remember you saying at some point you wanted me as a supervisor because you knew I wouldn't give you too much trouble, but you were also a little bit afraid of me.
Yeah,
But I also want to add, and you're probably going to
sure
edit
sure
this out, but I remember
Oh, I
getting your
don't tell.
application and I said to Nicole Marcotic, what am I going to do with this? I don't know this guy, he could go either way. He could be good, he could be terrible, he could be an arrogant little jerk. And she said, he sounds like a snarky little white boy. This is what you're going to write back. And so she dictated that letter.
Oh, you
So here I
see.
am, years later, with a
Yeah.
snarky white boy,
That's funny. Oh, there you
fast
go.
friends.
Yeah. Well, thanks for being such a great friend over the years, Suzette, and congrats again on your Giller Prize win. It's the only time I ever watched the Giller Prize, and I was not disappointed. So.
That's very kind of you. It's just between you and me, it's the first time I ever watched the Taylor Prize too.
Well,
So
I'm gonna.
there you
Do you need me to edit
No,
that
that's no,
out?
it's the truth. I'll stand
Yeah.
by it. Yeah.
Well, thanks again talking to me, and we'll talk again soon, I hope, and keep writing the wrong ways instead.
My pleasure, and thank you for helping me write the wrong way.